Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the remote meeting of the Legacy Finance Committee to order this morning. I welcome everyone. Mr. O'Neill, our clerk, will you be able to take a roll, please?
Certainly. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Representative Lilly present. Representative Jordan.
Jordan present.
Representative Jordan present. Representative Green.
Present.
Representative Green present. Representative Ackum.
Present.
Representative Ackum present. Representative Anderson.
Anderson present.
Representative Anderson present. Representative Bo.
Bo present.
Representative Bo present. Representative Christensen. Representative Hassan. Representative Murphy.
Murphy present.
Representative Murphy present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Representative Erdahl.
Erdahl present.
Representative Wazlowick.
Wazlowick present.
Representative Zhang.
Present.
Mr. Chair, we have a quorum.
Thank you.
Sean Christensen is present. I'm sorry, excuse me.
Oh, thank you.
Okay.
We'll note that Christensen is present, and so we're open for business, and even with Mary's frozen toes. So, Vice Chair Jordan, would you be willing to move the minutes from our February 16th meeting, please?
Yes, Mr. Chair. With the I spoke to our clerk about some of the PDF typos, and so yes, he will be taking care of that. But I do move the minutes.
Okay. So the minutes have been moved. Any questions regards to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? The minutes are approved. Thank you, Vice Chair Jordan. And today we're kind of moving through the different pieces of the puzzle of the legacy funds, and this morning, we're going to hear an update from the folks that are working on the parks and trails components of the fund. And as we all know and have seen the last couple of years, these parks and trails are being loved to death. So I'm very excited to hear what they're doing and how they're responding to COVID, and then what they need from us as well. So good morning, Ms. Madsen. I think you're kicking off, and welcome from from the Northland. I understand you had quite a bit of snow up there, and maybe it's more of a snowshoe morning up there or something, but please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you. Yes, it is indeed a winter wonderland up here, and I think it's this kind of a statewide winter wonderland. Chair Lilly and committee members, thank you very much for the opportunity to provide an overview of the great work that's being accomplished with the Parks and Legacy Trails funds. We're here today to share our vision for a well-integrated system of regional and statewide parks and trails, as well as to share some of the ways that COVID has affected how these assets are used and the changes that have been made to ensure parks and trails, as well as programs, were available during this challenging times. I'm Renee Madsen. I'm the Executive Director of the Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission, and I'm here with my colleagues, Lisa Barajas from the Metropolitan Council and Ann Pierce from the DNR. And both will be introducing themselves more fully as they talk about their systems later on. Together, we represent the joint leadership of Minnesota's three regional and statewide parks and trails entities, and we've been really fortunate to have a strong working relationship across our agencies to coordinate the legacy investments in our systems, which benefit all Minnesotans. And today we'll give you an overview of the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund, as well as a snapshot of how legacy works in each of our systems. Lars, slide two, please. And also Lars Erdahl, who is our legacy coordinator, behind the scenes pulling the strings and making sure all of these slides are up. I know you're all familiar with the 25-year Parks and Trails Legacy Plan, this beautiful plan. If anyone needs a hard copy of that, please let me know. I'll be happy to send you out one. I just want to touch briefly on the vision that's described in that plan, which is to provide a seamless accessible, and welcoming system of parks and trails for all Minnesotans and everyone else for that matter. And we know that parks and trails provide a variety of physical and mental health benefits for us, shown even more during the pandemic. Our Minnesota parks and trails reach a large, diverse audience and have become even more valued today than they were just 24 months ago. The next slide, please, Lars. There are four pillars described in the 25-year plan. Of course, you've all heard them over again, but I'm just going to briefly touch on how those pillars and how important they are. First one, of course, is connect people to the outdoors. And we do that through programs, education, interpretation, outdoor skills training, and special events. There's an increased focus on multicultural Minnesotans as well as youth. Also, acquire land and connect opportunity, acquire land and create opportunities. And we do that through, that would be gaining high priority acquisitions, preserving our priority natural and cultural resources, expanding and connecting our trails and significant development projects that encourage outdoor recreation participation and enhance natural and cultural resource management. Of course, take care of what we have. We need to take care of and renew our well-loved resources, which are even more loved, of course, these past couple of years, and provide for enhanced accessibility and manage and restore our natural landscapes. And then finally, coordinate with partners. And we do this through providing information for park users and visitors and working together to provide a seamless network that everyone can enjoy across the state. And these four pillars really provide us the foundation for the work that we do. Next slide. We all work really hard to engage with the public and listen and learn from them. And we have the Parks and Trails Legacy Advisory Committee, which provides us guidance and focus on that 25-year plan. The committee is made up of 17 members from across the state, and they have varied experiences and ideas and provide us with valuable input. And some of the key takeaways from that committee and the listening sessions that we've done over time are that many people's identities as Minnesotans are really tied to having good parks and trails and natural resources available to them. That Minnesotans place a high value on taking care of our facilities and in preserving the natural resources found in our parks and trails. We see health and wellness benefits by recreating in parks and trails, and it's an activity that for many of us have become really a part of our daily lives. We continue to work on being more accessible and welcoming to people with different backgrounds and abilities. We continue to work on public awareness of the amazing resources we have, and we do that through marketing and outreach. And in sessions, you know, we learned that older participants are really concerned about preserving these natural resources for younger generations and teaching them about nature and outdoor activities. So we three agencies continue to work on joint projects to provide a seamless system with our Minnesota Great Outdoors website, as well as our coordinated research projects. Next slide, Lars. Now, of course, what we wanted to touch on today was the impacts of the pandemic on our systems, which happened, of course, in 2020, 2021, and of probably into 2022 as well. People, as we know, really took to the outdoors as an escape. And as a result, visitation and participation rates across the three systems really increased. Now, hopefully that trend continues into the future, because people learned how close they were to outdoor resources maybe they didn't realize they had in their backyards, and rediscovered or discovered a new love for the outdoors. So the pandemic was in many ways a blessing to get people outdoors and experience what we have available to them. But with the increased visitation, recreation providers really had to manage what was an opportunity and of course a challenge to keep people safe. The Minnesota Department of Health and all of the partners and their agencies coordinated on outdoor recreation guidelines to help keep everyone safe, but still providing the much needed recreational opportunities people needed. We know that we connected new visitors to the outdoors as a result of the pandemic. And now the big question is, will that trend really continue? Will people continue to do something they found they loved? We don't yet have a lot of quantifiable data on the numbers of new visitors or what the retention rates will be once the pandemic's over. But we do know that there was a heightened interest in all of our systems, and that's great. And this is a really great opportunity to connect people this time of hardship to a lifetime in the outdoors. And the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund is really a critical funding source to advance that opportunity that we found. Next slide. And of course, here we've got some visuals that we've become familiar with, the adaptations that were made to the systems to respond to COVID. Signage was, of course, and always will be important because of the many new users unfamiliar with the resources available to them. It's always important to have great signage, and we discovered it was even more important during COVID because in addition to guidance and directions, we want everyone to have a really positive and welcoming experience so that they return. There's nothing more frustrating than being in the middle of a trail system, for instance, with bad directions and you're not exactly sure where you are. It's happened to me on more than one occasion, but I don't claim to have good directional sense. And of course, we all learned that term social distancing. The benefit though for us of providing outdoor experiences is that it's inherently easier to have fun outdoors and still be social distanced. Dog sledding and our socially distanced visit with Santa here are just two of the many, many examples we have of great activities and programs that happened, but still had social distancing attached. And then of course we had to, interpretive and outdoor skills programming had to adapt during programming. And while some programs had to be canceled, a lot of others just adapted by having fewer participants in the program and just offering more sessions. And of course, virtual programs like today's became part of the landscape and probably without a doubt will continue because we did reach large audiences. So that was important as people adapted. So with this just brief overview of the system generally, I'm going to move on to our individual presentations, which I know you're anxious to hear about, and how the strategies for investments continue in our respective systems. So we'll start with me still talking at you, sorry about that. But of course, Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails Commission. And here is a wonderful photo taken at Detroit Mountain Recreation Area near Detroit Lakes. And this is pre-COVID, people are a little bit closer, but it's just a fabulous facility and one of the many examples of the facilities in the 80 counties outside the metro area that are represented by Greater Minnesota. Next slide, please, Lars. The Greater Minnesota system is made up of 67 parks and trails. Of those parks and trails, 22 are regional trails, 33 are natural resource-based parks, and 12 are special features. And the photo on the left is a really great example of what would be considered a trail as well as a special feature. It's a photo of bikers on a bridge on the 100-mile Duluth Traverse, and that runs the length of the city. The importance of this traverse is that it has so many connection points to neighborhoods along the route. It makes it very easy for neighborhoods to access the larger trail system. The system's also accessible, and you'll see the photo just, the fellow in the photo just out of the frame there a little bit. That's an adaptive bike on the trail. And the Duluth Traverse with the city of Duluth was successful this past year in achieving a Connecting People with the Outdoors grant that will allow them to purchase a mobile mountain bike fleet. And by having this a mobile fleet, we can the Duluth Traverse and the city can bring programs and instruction into these neighborhoods along the Traverse. The, of course, benefit to that is we can get the programs to kids who might not have transportation to get to a program. So everyone can experience the ability to learn how to mountain bike if they don't have the equipment and get instruction as they go. So it's a really great example of connecting people with the outdoors. And then the photo on the top right is a climbing wall at Rochester's Quarry Hill Park. That's a really great park. It's really used heavily all year round. They've got hiking and biking, bird watching, of course, this climbing wall, fishing, fossil hunting, and just a really broad scope of activities available to them. They also have really popular natural science programs and summer camps for kids. And then the photo in the bottom of the frame here is one of our really unique assets. This is Olmsted County Oxbow Park and Zolman Zoo. it's a unique facility, and it's a fabulous facility, and that they've experienced so much of an increase in the past 10 years of participants in their nature programs. They've experienced a growth of 20% a year for the past 10 years, so pretty amazing. And they achieved a grant through Greater Minnesota Legacy Grants to expand their nature center. In addition to expanding the footprint, because it's just the facility is just way too small for all of the programs they're doing, they're also making it much more accessible and changing the flow so that the naturalist-led classes can continue to expand. So these are just three examples of some of the types of facilities within our system. Next slide, please, Lars. So of course, we want to make parks and trails welcoming and accessible for everyone. The photo of the three fellows smiling at the camera there in the upper left was during a site visit this past summer to look at a funding proposal from Cascade Lake Park in Rochester. Cascade Lake Park is a very urban park in Rochester that's being created out of a former gravel mine on the site. And over years, they've been successful in gaining legacy grants with some really significant investments also by the city of Rochester. The latest grant is for connecting people with the outdoors through a 20,000 square foot universally accessible nature playground, and it's right next adjacent to an existing playground. This one is based for children of 2 to 12 years of all abilities, and it's going to be a fabulous addition to that urban landscape. Then just below that, we've got one of the many great programs that happens at Wright County Robert Nye Park. This one happens to be a snowshoeing adventure, but they do just a great range of activities in that park. And then the final photo here is Red Wings Heemaneechan or Barn Bluff Park. And this is showing one of the many interpretive panels at the Welcome Plaza to the park. Barn Bluff, of course, is a very noticeable feature. If you've been to Red Wing, it's impossible to miss. And the bluff is filled with many hiking trails that have been improved and made much more sustainable over time with some of the legacy grants. These pillars in the park, the work was done in the park in conjunction with the Prairie Island Indian community. So city leaders and the Prairie Island Indian community worked together really hard to incorporate and teach the history of the Midwakanton Dakota people in the park. On these storyteller panels, there are buttons and you can hear the words spoken in Dakota, as well as read the English and Dakota versions. The panels teach people about the important history of the bluffs and the area and the Midwakanton Dakota people. And it's a great example of a partnership that worked very, very hard on a place that meant a lot to different entities and came together to make just an amazing park. I really encourage everyone to visit it if you have the opportunity. This is just a small glimpse of what's available, but I think shows off really well what can be done when people give thought and consideration and have important conversations across different cultures. And then finally, the last slide. So parks and trails also are great places to find unique, pretty little art in the systems. On the left is a really cute arty bridge that's in Lake County Mountain Bike Trail System. And you can also see the legacy sign there on the bridge. This is a new system that's going to be opening next summer, as a matter of fact. And it's connected to the new DNR Shipwreck Creek Campground at Split Rock State Park. So some of the easiest trail connections on this mountain bike trail system that's been built brand new are going to be leading out of that new campground so that families that are there can really learn a new skill on the green trails that will lead into the blue intermediates and the black diamond trails that are quite a bit more difficult and scare me just to look at, but it's an amazing system. In the top right, we've got the painting party that happened for the Gull Lake Trail. And that's a really great example of a cooperative partnership. The trail partnership came together through the work of the communities of Nisswa, Lake Shore, East Gull Lake, and Fairview Township. And it's a beautiful paved trail that traverses around the lake. It's actually really important for the safety of visitors and residents to the area. And a great example of a multi-partnership that found it important to work together to achieve this pretty big goal. And then finally, we've got one of my favorite sculptures. This is Sandhill Crane sculpture at Isanti County Irving and John Anderson Park. And we get the greatest photos from the park manager of people around the sculptures. There are actually two Sandhill Crane sculptures in the park. And this little girl is doing a great job of imitating the crane. We see photos of adults doing the same thing. So it's a magnet for all people who want to have fun and just something unexpected in a great park in Minnesota. So that is the brief overview. In the middle, of course, is a system plan with all 67 of the currently designated regionally significant parks and trails in greater Minnesota. And it looks like there's a question perhaps from Representative Erdahl.
Yes, I do have a question, Mr. Chairman.
You're on mute, Representative Lilly.
I'm talking away. Go ahead, Representative Erdahl.
Yes, just wondering how important connectivity is for these trails or having destinations. Is that something that's strongly looked at?
It is. I'm sorry, Chair Lilly, Representative Erdahl. Yes, the connections to the trails are very important. You know, there's great examples throughout Minnesota of regional trails that connect to state trails or metropolitan area trails, local trail connections from smaller communities to the larger trail systems. So that's a really important part of what all three of the systems provide is connections to communities. And actually, there's a lot of great examples of trails that in greater Minnesota that connect to state park assets as well.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I like to hear that. I think that's very good. I mean, I have a little idea for maybe connecting a trail with a state recreation area at some point in the future. So we'll talk more about that later. Or a trail that goes by the biggest ball of twine made by one man in Darwin. All right, thank you.
We've never heard of that. Representative Green, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm going to probably just ask this question first, and that is there's more testifiers bringing forth stuff, right? Because I had questions on long-term maintenance and the usage of the trails, but if the other testifiers are going to talk about that, I'll wait until you get there.
That's a good question. Maybe it's best handled by all three. Do you have so maybe wait on that one. Do you have an additional question, Representative Green?
No, let's see if they hit all the points first.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Ms. Madsen, are you?
So I am. Okay. Yes, that wraps up Greater Minnesota's information. And with that, I'd like to turn it over to my colleague at the Metropolitan Regional Park System, Lisa Barajas.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members.
Ms. Barajas, good morning. Welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready. Thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. Again, my name is Lisa Barajas, and I'm the Executive Director of the Community Development Division at the Metropolitan Council. And on behalf of the council and our 10 regional park implementing agencies, I thank you for the opportunity to present the overview of the regional park system's efforts since we last met during the 2021 legislative session. Next slide, please, Lars. Here, just as I referenced, we have the 10 regional parks implementing agencies. They're the responsible for owning and operating the components of the regional park system. The council serves as the coordinating body with with these 10 agencies, and we are charged with long-range planning as well as serving as the fiscal agent for the system as a whole. The council itself does not own or operate the regional parks, but as the fiscal agents, the council does pass through 100% of the legacy dollars directly to our 10 agencies. In addition, the council matches the state funding with millions of its own dollars, including matching parks and trails legacy funds used for acquiring park and trail land. Next slide, please. This is a map of the regional park system. We have 44 regional parks, 10 park reserves, 8 special recreation features, and 55 regional trails with 415 miles currently open to the public. This equates to almost 55,000 acres of parkland. And we like to say that the regional park system is like the state park system, but in the metro area. But we do have great state park components within the metro area, and they're a great asset to the region. These opportunities in the regional park system offer a similar state park-like experience for folks right in their own backyard. And with the system of trails that we're hoping to get, as Representative Erdahl, I believe, mentioned earlier, to really create an interconnected system across our region and connecting to the other state and regional park assets in the state of Minnesota. The Parks and Trails Legacy Fund does help make the regional park system a true gateway to all of Minnesota's amazing outdoor opportunities, as I mentioned, both in the regional system, but including the state park system and the greater Minnesota regional system. Next slide, please. I'm going to focus on just two of our pillars today, because that's where a lot of our legacy dollars in the metro are spent. And that relates to connecting people in the outdoors in particular. One major focus for our parks and trail legacy investments is to create introductory experiences for new visitors, really capturing and addressing the opportunity that Renee had mentioned around that increased usage and really bringing people back to the parks that are right in their own backyard and showing them all the different ways that they can find enjoyment and recreation opportunities in those systems. So on this slide, you'll see a few examples from Three Rivers Park District, which covers Western Hennepin County largely, as well as some additional areas. But by focusing on introductory experiences, we reach broader audiences, some of whom have never visited regional parks and trails before. Many of these introductory experiences are free of charge and provide equipment and lessons for teaching new outdoor skills. So on this slide, really taking advantage of winter opportunities, as folks sometimes think we don't do anything in the winter, especially if you're not from Minnesota, but everyone knows if you're here in Minnesota that we're outdoors all year round, and showing folks how they can take advantage of those opportunities right in their own backyard really makes, as we talked about earlier today, really takes advantage of the winter wonderland that we have available right here in our backyards. Next slide, please. Some summertime activities here too that you can see. Some more photos showing ways of residents of the metro area can learn new outdoor skills. These photos are from a series of events sponsored by Dakota County and Outdoor Latino. The emphasis of these events is on fun and learning new outdoor skills. So you see both canoeing and archery, more active summertime skills that you can see in in our regional systems in Dakota County, as well as skiing opportunities in Dakota County. And I gotta say, there's some really great skiing here in the metro area. And some of our courses within our regional parks not only host middle school and high school sporting events for Nordic ski, but also are some competitive races that help you get ready for some potential Olympic opportunities, as our own Jesse Diggins experienced. Next slide, please. And speaking of skiing, our final slide is an example of a really exciting Ramsey County project to construct a winter recreation area at Battle Creek Regional Park. Excuse me, they are committed to increasing equitable access to our regional system. And this is a true opportunity to make snow in the East Metro, where we didn't have that previously. There's a lot of snowmaking activity in West Metro regional parks that really expand the Nordic ski season, especially when we have a season that starts late, like we did this year without snow, much of anything in December, and we were waiting around for it and just, come on, where's it coming? But in the West Metro, the ability to make snow has really given that opportunity for folks to get out and participate both in Nordic skiing and also some sledding opportunities, and also expand our season into the later winter months as well. So this opportunity in the East Metro will really open up additional access for residents on the east side of the metro without having to drive so far, especially through sometimes some hairy traffic through the metro to get to some of those western opportunities. We're really excited to see this come online. Battle Creek, if you haven't been out there, is just a gorgeous park and has some of the best hiking and running, and if you're into running activities, and also Nordic ski activities with some pretty steep climbs as well for Nordic skiing. So with that, I really would like to turn it over to Ann Pierce now, our new State Parks and Trails Director. Thank you.
Thank you for your presentation. And, you know, certainly we, as legislators, always love the match. And that's, and then I think that's pretty a neat part of what the Metro brings. Ms. Pierce, good morning. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and members. I'm Ann Pierce, and I am the Director for Parks and Trails with the Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning.
And Lars, you can move to the next one. So just a little bit of information that might answer some of the questions asked previously. Since 1891, Minnesota State Parks and Trails System has grown. So today we have 75 state parks and state recreational areas, 25 multi-use state trails, 35 state water trails with 1,700 public water accesses, and plus we have state forest recreational areas and fishing piers and more in our state system. We had about 12 million state park visitors in 2020, and we're still gathering some of the information for 2021, but we know that the seasonal passes were up from 2020, even though the day passes may have been slightly down from 2020. We had about 3 million state trail visitors in 2020, and just to give you a sense for the paved trails, which the state paved trails are about 660 miles, we had about 1.2 million visitors each summer for those trails. So a great system and great partnerships with the other recreational systems around the state and showing, maintaining those connections and partnerships. So Lars, you can move to the next slide. I am also going to talk a little bit about some of the focus for the pillars that Renee mentioned earlier. And again, one of the pillars that the Department of Natural Resources is working on along with our partners is connecting people to the outdoors. And there's some really interesting things that I'm going to highlight in this presentation. Our primary strategy for connecting people to the outdoors is by trying to promote innovative programs and providing education, interpretation, and outdoor skill training. We also do a lot of marketing and promotions and special events that'll engage families in outdoor activities and encourage natural resource stewardship, especially inviting people to try things that they haven't necessarily tried before. So in an efforts to reduce some of the barriers and improve access, build those skills, and welcome all Minnesotans to our state recreational system. One of the things that we identified in 2021, and it was actually launched in June 2021, was the new Library Pass program. You can see that in the left-hand corner of that slide. There's a picture of the pass on a dash, and then a picture of kind of the promotional pieces for that. So that was launched in June 2021. We had 71 libraries in low-income areas throughout the state that have the pass available. In the first 6 months of that program, we had 1,500 checkouts of that pass. And when we did some informational gathering, we found that over 95% of the people who used them would use them again. Over 98% said that they would visit a state park again. And 63% of the respondents for this survey, their income was less than $75,000, whereas 58% of the state parks visitors in 2017 had a household income of less than $75,000. So this is one of those things which I think was a big success in trying to lower those barriers to some of the people of Minnesota to using and getting out in our recreational areas. Another thing that we're looking at to increase the information that's out there and do some multicultural marketing is we're looking at our Trailblazer newsletter, and we really re-envisioned that newsletter and reformatted it to increase diverse representation in outdoor recreation and to reach new audiences to better reflect the diversity of parks and trails and the users of those parks and trails. So this is just an example you can see of that newsletter that goes out. Also, we have focused on some interpretation exhibits. And on the right-hand corner, you'll see a picture of an interpretation exhibit that provides audio description services so that people with visual disabilities can also enjoy the interpretive exhibit. And we have a new interpretive project that incorporated Ojibwe history and language into the interpretive products of that site in partnership with the Ojibwe tribes. So Lars, you can move to the next slide. Another example, which I think probably people are somewhat familiar with, that the department is looking at to connect people to the outdoors, and both Renee and Lisa also mentioned some of these programs of getting people to try new skills, and it's our I Can program. Minnesota State Parks and Trails I Can program's focus is to build skills and accessibility to welcome everyone to Minnesota's outdoors. And it's designed for families to try any or for people who have experience, but also really focused on those first time users. And it gives them hands-on instruction from experienced and friendly staff. And it's also all the gear that they need will be provided. And it is affordable and in many cases free for the participants. It also can serve, you know, our regular state park users in many ways. There are people that have been using our state parks but may not have tried all the activities that are available in that state park. And so they can use these ICANN programs to learn some new skills. Maybe they're focused on, you know, paddling sports and they've never tried the mountain biking, but they can learn that through some of these ICANN programs. And Lars, you can move to the next one. So I think there was also a question about kind of trying to maintain the infrastructure that we have in place. And one of the pillars I'm going to talk about next is that need to take care of what we have, but to also create some opportunities on the landscape. So if you look at the pictures above, the Temperance River State Park, this is a new shower building, and park users now can have this modern facility, family-friendly climate, and have it available so that they can use it and have a comfortable experience at the Temperance River State Park. So part of providing that welcoming experience is to meet the expectations for having these quality facilities, and in doing this restoration, we have included renovations to the shower and restrooms at this building so state park users can enjoy that and feel more comfortable. In creating new opportunities, the slide or the picture on the right is of Glacial Lake State Trail in Sibley Park, and this there was supplementary funds provided to make this trail safe, accessible, and welcoming to trail users. And Lars, you can head on to the next one. So another example of creating opportunities I'm going to talk about is something that Renee mentioned, the Shiprock Creek Campground at Split Rock Lighthouse State Park. So the idea of this campground is part of the original park management plan from 1980, and Construction on this campground began in November 2019 and continued through the fall of 2021. So for everyone here, stay tuned for the grand opening. We're anticipating that to be this spring in 2022. The new campground features paved trail connections, just like Renee had mentioned, to the Gitchigami State Trail, a parking area, connections to the Lake County Split Rock Wild Mountain biking trails, which are also under construction. And the campground will have three loops with 46 campsites, or has three loops with 46 campsites that are kind of nestled into the hills above Lake Superior. So great experience for users. It's very family friendly. It has electrical hookup at each campsite, modern shower and bath building, as you can see in the picture on the top right. And the approximately 7.5 million of this system, of the funding for this system, came from the Parks and Trails Legacy Fund. And so this is a real nice example of where money has been spent to really increase, improve, and provide these experiences in partnership with other partners in the Legacy Fund. In addition to that, matching some of those dollars, there was about $1.6 million from the Lake, that Lake County funded from a roadway through a grant from the State Park Road account. So, Lars, you can now move to the next slide. So we are the Clean Water Land and Legacy Amendment that goes between 2009 and 2034. So we are at kind of the halfway point of this funding, which is amazing. I remember when this was passed, it doesn't seem that long ago, but we are halfway at the halfway point. And in at that halfway point, some of the things that I just wanted to highlight that I think have really grown out of what has happened with this legacy funding, but not just the dollars that are being spent on the ground, but also those partnerships. So now that each of the partners has presented, you may notice that there are some common themes that we're working together on and clearly creating partnerships. I think direction is one of them. We're each guided by specific statutory direction, as well as a 25-year Parks and Trails legacy plan. And our efforts have been informed by this broad-based citizen involvement. And we each have a system in place to advance in our shared legacy work. And we're working in partnership to create those connections, create kind of a unified park system across Parks and Trails system across the state. We work together closely with the Parks and Trails Legacy Advocacy Committee, which is a 17-member citizen-led group, as you know, and they help advise to create this seamless outdoor recreational system. And what you see, the results and the accountability, are a result of those partnerships. So since the amendment passed, the three partners have already made significant legacy accomplishments, as you can see, many of which were described today, and we track and report on progress through the Legislative Coordinating Committee website, and we remain committed to communicating this to this group and to, or to this committee and to the public also. So with that, I just wanted to thank you and open it up for any questions if people have them.
Yeah, thank you, Ms. Pierce and Ms. Barajas and Ms. Mattson and Representative Green.
Thanks, Chair Willie. My first question would actually, I would like an answer from all three testifiers if possible, and that is on the long-term maintenance. And by that I mean, is there money put aside going into the future? And for instance, we can start with the trails. The question will also fall over into the buildings and other materials that you have out there. So, for instance, let's take the paved trails first. for all three testifiers. What's the half-life of these trails?
Who wants to go first? Ms. Madsen?
Thank you, Chair Lilly, Representative Green. For trails, first of all, let me just tell you a little bit about the process. When we designate a park or trail facility in Greater Minnesota, it's a pretty stringent process. And one of the things that we ask for when we determine whether or not they're eligible for designation is if they do have a long-range maintenance and operations plan in place. So we recognize when we're funding a new facility, obviously there's going to be repairs and maintenance necessary over the life of that facility or trail. So we look for what their plans are to maintain that trail, how they, where the budget is going to be and how much they're setting aside each year to maintain a trail or facility. We're certainly available to do those, take care of what we have projects, but annual minor maintenance on a trail, we believe is the responsibility of the entity that has that trail in place. So it's certainly something we look very strictly at when we're designating a facility to take all of those budget considerations under advisement as we move along.
Ms. Pierce, I understand that Ms. Barajas from the Met Council had to step off. So, Ms. Pierce?
Yes. Thank you, Chair Lilly. So, in general, a paved trail is repaved about every 25 years. So the kind of lifespan for needing repavement would be by 20 to 30 years. That's going to be dependent on conditions, landscape, context that it's in, a variety of things like that. But kind of a repaving would be between 20 and 30 years, about estimate 25 years.
Looks like Mr. Mullins here to kind of step in for, go ahead. Sir, introduce yourself first, please.
Good morning, Chair Lilly and members of the committee. Thanks for having me. My name is Emmett Mullen, and I'm the manager of the Metropolitan Council's Regional Parks Unit, and I work every day with those 10 regional park implementing agencies. Very quickly, Representative Green, excellent question. The whole taking care of what we have pillar, that's the third pillar in the plan, is really focused on that regular reinvestment. All 10 of our agencies have regular reinvestment strategies so that, because they know and we've learned that as soon as the quality, particularly on trails, goes down, they won't be used. They basically are taken out. Our park agencies do excellent pavement planning. That's literally a field. And they have learned, as Ann was talking, that generally the lifespan of a trail is about 20 to 25 years. Through regular investment in pavement planning, we can extend the life of those trails double. But that is does require regular reinvestment in those public facilities. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It wasn't really a clear answer, and maybe they don't have a clear answer. I do know, just as an example, it was a couple of years ago now, just for your information, a lot of Minnesota, all of Minnesota freezes, but where I live, and a lot of trails go through wetlands, and the frost does severe damage to these trails. And I had a 70-year-old man that came to me, and he didn't know if he was going to be able to even ride anymore his bike because on the trail he hit a spot where the trail had separated, and when he fell, he broke his shoulder. And so I don't think that it's realistic to believe that these things are going to go 20 to 30 years. At least not where I live. Now, I don't know if the frost boils and stuff are as severe in the metro area, but I suspect that in certain places they probably are. And so I'd like to see a much better plan moving ahead as to guaranteeing that these trails are, if we're going to put the money into them, that no one's going to get hurt on them. And so I'd like to see a little bit different there. And then I do believe that the trails in the metro area are probably used a lot more than they are in our area. We can see some of the bike trails that maybe don't have anybody on them for days. And so what do you know in the different districts, and you keep track of what percentage of the people might use those trails?
Maybe we should focus on Ms. Madsen, and then we got to make Ms. Madsen go ahead. And I see we have another question from Representative Anderson. Go ahead, Ms. Madsen.
Chair Lilly, Representative Green. I have to tell you that much of Greater Minnesota does not have trail counters on the trails on a regular basis. I do know from two of our partner systems in Greater Minnesota, the Cannon Valley Trail and the Mesabi Trail, who both charge wheel passes. The Cannon Valley Trail has well in excess of 200,000 riders a year, as does the Mesabi Trail. So clearly those trails are well ridden. We believe that that's indicative of the trail systems throughout Greater Minnesota that don't have wheel passes. And we're doing research projects with our partners at DNR and Metropolitan Council to get a better idea of just what exactly the ridership is on our trails over the next year. And that's a coordinating among partners project. So while I can't give you exact amounts, I can tell you that the trail systems in Greater Minnesota, anecdotally from our partner agencies, are very, very well ridden all year long, as a matter of fact. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Madsen. Representative Green.
Well, Mr. Chair Lilly, I'm just going to ask two more questions. I'll ask them right away, and then I'll give other people a chance. And if there's more time at the end, maybe we can dig into it deeper. As far as the trail usage goes, I would like to know how you distinguish between people who maybe one person uses that trail over and over again. I've also heard that as your counters are in place, one person can actually be counted four or five times as they ride down that trail if they take it far enough. And so I'd like to know how accurate those counts are. But one question that I'm hoping that the DNR can answer is, a few years ago, way back when Commissioner Landwehr was in, he had made the comment that only out of the 75 parks and recreational areas, only like 20 of them were making money. So the others were kind of a drain on there. And he even made the comment that one was so underused that it would be better to give everybody that came there $20 and send them somewhere else, because it was a big drain on the funding for those. So are you still keeping track of that? So do you know how much money we have to stick into the trails every year, or the parks, I should say, the parks every year, because we're not getting enough people buying the permits to come in to maintain those parks?
Ms. Pierce, I think we'll focus on that. And then, I think I overscheduled this meeting. I don't know. But go ahead, Ms. Pierce.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly. Yes, we still are looking into the information on park use and where the parks, what parks are being heavily used and what parks are not as heavily used. I can certainly talk with our staff and get more information to you, but I know that, you know, as we went into the pandemic, we saw that great increase across the state. And that has at least continued into the next year. We're seeing that increase, and we're also doing a lot of work to kind of make an effort to promote all parks. We have, you know, some underused gems out there, but we're making an effort to make sure that people know where they are and doing some connections piece. We had a free park day last Saturday, and we did some connecting pieces for people to look at. There's three, four parks right along 35. You know, go to each of those as you have this free park day. And so we're doing some promotional stuff to increase the awareness of where the parks are, what parks have to offer, and things like that.
Representative Green.
Well, thank you. It sounds like you tried the if we build it, they will come, but they're not coming. But then on the other part of the question too, if they want to get to that. But I think for right now, We'll let everybody else ask their questions, and if there's time left, we'll come back.
Yeah, thank you, Representative Green. These are good questions, and just good to have the dialogue. I'm guilty as a chair. I might overscheduled, and I certainly don't want to mess with the Children's Museum and Mary Murphy would brutally get me if I mess with the libraries. So, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. Just a quick comment on what the Representative Green was talking about, the trail maintenance. One thing I see happening on some of the bike trails or paved trails is tree roots. I mean, they can be a real problem with causing a heave and cracks. And I'm sure that's a difficult thing to try to manage, is tree roots growing up in these trails. But my question goes to Ms. Mattson, and on the regional parks and trails, mainly the parks, I guess. I heard from some folks back home trying to clean up a park, not necessarily a regional park, but they're really battling buckthorn. When you talk about maintenance, is that an issue with some of your regional parks, and do you devote some time or funding specifically for fighting buckthorn? And is there any money available for others to try to work against buckthorn? Is it a tough pest and hard to eradicate?
Ms. Mattson.
Chair Lilly, Representative Anderson, that's a great question. Buckthorn is the Achilles heel for much of the park systems. The Greater Minnesota Regional Parks and Trails System does not offer invasive species grants any longer. Our resources are fairly limited, but there are DNR programs that do offer those grants. So we do send our designated agencies that direction, but certainly everyone's aware of it, and there are many, many programs within those parks with friends groups who battle that buckthorn issue each and every spring and fall.
Thank you.
Thank you. Good question, Representative Anderson. Vice Chair Jordan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And actually, thank you, Representative Green, for your questions. They kind of inspired some of my thinking as well. I was hoping that Mr. Mullen could talk a little bit more about Metro Park use. I know that I have increased my usage of our parks in Minneapolis and in the metro area as well, and across the state, frankly. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about maintenance and how much of that is just increased use and wear and tear associated with that, and how much of it is just a lack of investment over the years. But can you talk about how the difference we've seen in use from in the metro area and how that has contributed to maintenance issues?
Mr. Mullen.
Thank you, Chair Lilly and Vice Chair Jordan. Great question about use. The last time we were able to conduct our annual use estimate was 2019, so it was before the pandemic. And what we found was we had over 63 million visits to our entire system. So we have a tremendously high amount of use. When the pandemic hit in 2020, we saw anecdotally even higher use than before. And we were not able to get, we have an intercept survey, so we were not able to put a field crew into the parks and trails in 2020. So that was kind of a bummer, because 2020 anecdotally was some of the most use that we have seen. 2021, we were able to get crews into the field to do our annual use estimate, and we will have that visitation information in July of this year. Your question about impacts to the system, we have seen a lot of wear and tear. You know, I don't mean this in a, but you know, our resources can get loved to death because so many people are out there, and you know, when people use the trails, when they use the parks, they need regular reinvestment, and that's certainly what we're doing. But that is a big concern moving forward with increased use. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullen. Vice Chair Jordan?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Mr. Mullen, for that. I know I'm one of those people that has taken, that has really taken to our parks these past couple of years. And I think we'll see a lot of people like myself who have maybe, you know, quit Lifetime and are now just spending all their time running around Lake Nokomis instead. So I'm hopeful that we can, I think we'll see a lot, we'll continue to see that use. And so we need to be better in this committee about planning for a generation of outdoors people, which is great.
Thank you. And thank you, everyone. Thank you for the presentation today. I certainly know that they're getting loved to death. I've noticed in Minneapolis, they had to shut down streets, you know, push the people off the trails into the streets because there was just so many people to give some sort of safe spacing. And I mean, it's a great problem. And I've actually seen the DNR system and the greater Minnesota, just the pressures there as well. And I do have a challenge I want to throw out before we go. The greater Minnesota people had a great brochure, and I challenge the other two systems to create something similar, because the piece that they put together was really class act, and it showed all the regions of the state. And so I hope the Met Council can do the same in the DNR, so we can see where the money's going. That would be something. Well, thank you everyone for coming, and I hope you're available for questions, and we might have you back even if I know you'd be open to that. Again, thank you. So we're going to switch over to the public, over to the libraries, and I'm quite excited to hear this discussion this morning. And I'm not sure who's kicking off, but I think Ms. Smith, are you getting us going here? And Mary Murphy's got me, turned me into a library lover, and pretty much every conversation we're talking about what we're reading. And, but I know that you know, the last discussion kind of turned into with you, where you're offering the, you know, the DNR park pass through your systems. But anyways, Ms. Smith, please kick us off and welcome.
Thank you very much. Good morning, Chair Lilly and committee members. My name is Erin Smith, and I'm the director of the Viking Library System. We're headquartered in Fergus Falls, and we serve six counties and 11 member libraries here in West Central Minnesota, where we are completely snowed under. So thank you for having us here today. And I did want to thank Ann Pierce for touching on the Library State Parks Passes partnership. In the Viking Library System region, we have four member libraries that have those passes, and they're frequently checked out. And in Pelican Rapids, one of the public libraries in our systems, they also check out snowshoes. So it's been a great partnership. Folks can come in, check out the pass, check out some snowshoes, and head over to Maplewood State Park. So we definitely know we have a lot of snow, so that's been a good benefit for people in our region. So since we met last, Minnesota's 363 public library locations continue to adapt legacy-funded programs to meet community. And as libraries transition back to providing some in-person arts, culture, and history programming, some of the innovative and new programming that was born out of necessity in regards to the pandemic has now become a staple as well. For example, some of the take and make programming, so think arts and crafts and STEAM-related learning kits to go, have been very popular with adults, teens, and preschoolers alike in libraries. The take and make format lends itself to everything from creative letter writing kits. For example, did you know that you can send a plastic bottle through the mail? And also things like handcrafted indigenous loop earrings have been formulated into take and make kits. Libraries are also providing more virtual programming than they ever have. And those virtual programs extend the reach into greater Minnesota and connect us with the metro area. So virtual means that an aspiring writer, for example, from Browns Valley can learn the craft by connecting with an artist mentor from the Loft Literary Center in Minneapolis. And one such novice writer who attended a virtual writing workshop in the Viking Library System recently shared I'm so happy that I took this Zoom class. We plan to write our adoption story for our son. We adopted him from Romania, and it was a long process. So while the 12 regional public library systems anticipate being able to meet our current legacy funding spending deadlines, one of the questions was, would an extension be helpful? And the systems would be grateful for any extension should that be deemed acceptable. The extension would help libraries as we pivot again to providing more in-person programming while also continuing to maintain the effective virtual take and make programs and virtual writing workshops and other programs that have been successful during the pandemic. So thank you for giving us the opportunity to share how public libraries continue to meet the needs of Minnesotans in all corners of our state. And that wraps it up for my portion. I wanted to keep it short. For the regional library systems, and I'd like to turn it over now to Beth Burns, the president of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library, to share information about the programming supported through the Minnesota Center of the Book.
Thank you, Ms. Smith, and I always enjoy hearing what you what you're doing and what's going on out there, and it's just the snowshoe thing was interesting. I hadn't heard that one. So, Ms. Burns, please introduce yourself. Welcome this morning and go ahead when you're ready, please.
Thank you, Chairman Lilly, Representative Murphy, and all members of the committee. My name is Beth Burns, and yes, I do serve in St. Paul as the director of the Friends of the St. Paul Public Library, but appear for you today as the director of the Minnesota Center for the Book. And just as a quick reminder, the Center for the Book is a program of the Library of Congress based out of Washington, D.C. Every state in the country has a designated Center for the Book, and in Minnesota, we hold that designation and, as such, produce programming in.
Ms. Burns, we're having a little bit, you're just a little soft.
If I do this, is that helpful?
Yep, thank you very much. Sorry.
Oh, thank you for pointing that out. My apologies. So as I was saying, what we work, our work as the Minnesota Center for the Book is really focused on partnering with and supporting libraries in every single corner of the state to deliver programs and services that each of these library systems maybe alone would not have the capacity to do. And so our legacy appropriation is really designated to creating that statewide portfolio. And just want to give you a few updates this morning about how that funding is being used under the current circumstances. You may recall we started a statewide book club in response to the pandemic when folks were moving online. This has actually grown into our single largest program since the start of the pandemic. One Book, One Minnesota has had multiple chapters where books are available to all Minnesotans, free to download and read together, and then come together for a program with the author. We just completed the most recent chapter with The Song Poet by Cao Kalia Yang, and that free reading program now has brought us to over 63,000 downloads of the reading materials since the program started. And Kalia's kind of capstone program, where she met virtually with readers around the state, 363 Minnesotans participated during that program, representing 60 Minnesota counties and 363 Minnesota zip codes. So we certainly know that this is a program with deep statewide impact. We're already looking ahead because of the success of this program, and anticipate that the next chapters of One Book, One Minnesota are going to include a middle grade fiction book by Brian Ferry, a yet to be determined mystery novel from very, very popular Minnesota author Kent Kruger, and the anthology We Are Meant to Rise, Voices for Justice from Minneapolis to the World, which is an anthology of Minnesota writers. So that's just one of the programs that your support through Legacy funds. Another program is Moving Words, and Moving Words went back into the real world this year, which has been really exciting. The libraries that we partner with to bring authors statewide into relationship with readers in libraries. The libraries had agency to decide whether or not they wanted the programming to be in person or to be virtual based on sort of community considerations. And so we hosted a mix this fall and served well over 200 attendees and additional viewers through that program. And Moving Words brought Minnesota Book Award authors, winners and finalists to Park Rapids, Worthington, Alexandria, Wilmer, Buffalo, Sauk Center, Rochester, Cloquet, and to the Lake Agassiz Regional Library. Some of those were in person, and that would be Worthington, Alexandria, Sauk Center, and others chose to go virtual. We are also really trying to learn how we can do our work better. So we're in the midst of conducting a writer's survey and really trying to understand what writers need from us in order to serve their communities and their readers really well. And we'll have more reporting available on that in coming months. And then I also want to remind that one of the things that was in process the last time I had the opportunity to speak with this committee was kind of reinvigorating the State Poet Laureate Program. And since the end of the last session, really excited that Mankato-based poet Gwen Westerman, who's an enrolled member of both the Cherokee Nation and the Dakota Aoyate, excuse me, my apologies, bands, she has been named the State Poet Laureate. That program is stewarded most closely by the Minnesota Humanities Center, but the Center for the Book is the statewide programming partner, and Representative Murphy in particular will be thrilled to know we are actually in the planning stages to bring poetry workshops this coming August into Minnesota State Parks that are focused on our connection to the land and to the natural world. So it's sort of just the perfect synthesis of all of the goals of our legacy program here in Minnesota. We continue to run the Minnesota Book Awards program. That will be in person April 26th. That is not funded through Legacy, but I would just mention it here as part of the complete portfolio of our activities. We run the Minnesota Writers Directory, which connects schools and libraries and book clubs and arts organizations with authors. And we just distributed 3,000 copies of these beautiful printed maps called Minnesota Writers on the Map to classrooms across the state. We are making good use of our legacy appropriation. You may recall we did not receive our full request in this biennium. And so if there's any opportunity for consideration of completing that funding source during this session, we would certainly be grateful and look forward to being good stewards of these funds and continuing to serve the state of Minnesota as your Library of Congress Center for the Book. And happy to take questions.
Thank you, Ms. Burns and Ms. Smith. I don't see any hands, but I think Representative Murphy, do you have anything at this point? I have one thing that I'd like to mention. I happen to live in Ramsey County and I get their brochure, and it's just amazing how many different programs are funded by Legacy. Just, and it's super exciting to me to think that it's, you know, happening all over the state and, you know, all the our 87 counties and all of our municipal libraries. And, you know, I'm hoping the same thing's happening that's happening in Ramsey County, which I'm sure it is. So, but so it was just, and a lot of those are cultural opportunities, and you know, it seems like there's thoughtful process. And it, Ms. Murphy, or Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members, Ms. Burns, Ms. Smith. You are doing wonderful work and you are listening and you have made connections, and that virtual meeting with Fond du Lac Tribe at Fond du Lac Community College sponsored and with the poet was an evening of that I would have never attended before the COVID. I would have never been able to get on a Zoom call in the evening with other readers across the state, listening to a National Poet Laureate begin our regional poet laureate reading some of their readings. And that was just a thrilling experience, and I want to do it again. And I don't know, is the book awards going to be on Zoom too, or is that in person only?
Chair Lilly, Representative Murphy.
Ms. Burns, yep.
Thank you. One of the things we have certainly learned is how important the virtual world is to access, particularly geographic access. We are going to be hosting the program both in person at the Ordway and simulcast virtually statewide for folks who are not able or interested to make the trip to St. Paul.
Well, that's great.
Representative Murphy.
Ms. Burns, Mr. Chair, that's great because sometimes just it's fun to get in the car and go, but sometimes it's not possible to get in the car and go, and yet you could still be there in person, but in the comfort of your big chair.
Exactly.
And there's something to that. There are people who might be more willing to take that chance from time to time. But today's meeting with the Parks and Trails and the activities and how we've shown that people of all walks of life travel many different paths, whether it's through a book or through a park or through a snowshoe or through just wishing you could go swimming kind of thing. And you, all the speakers today, and I expect the next two also, or the next one also, Ms. Curzon, you are working with existing groups and you are improving and enhancing their horizons, and they are doing the same with you. And I am so appreciative of that. And this was the real meaning of what the people that worked so hard to get the 2008 amendment passed. And it shows that we're working together and connecting Minnesotans of all ages and differences to sharing similar kinds of things, or at least giving them more opportunities to share. And that is what that money is all about. And so thank you, and keep hoping and keep cooperating and keep providing your examples. Go forth and do more good work.
Any additional questions for Ms. Burns or Ms. Smith? Thank you very much for coming and telling your story. And the libraries are so vital to our communities, and just an absolute treasure. It's, Representative Murphy said, just seeing the eyes and some of the pictures of the park pictures. But I was just in a library in the last week here, and just see the families and elderly folks, and just the mixture. They were doing taxes in the back room for people, but it was just all this interconnection. It's our new, a city center. The old downtown is kind of the library now, in a way. But and then connecting, and then the young readers are, of course, super exciting. Again, thank you for your work, and thank you for joining us, and we'll talk to you again soon. Thank you. So we're gonna switch again, and thank you, the libraries, for coming. That was a great presentation. We're gonna switch on to hear from our folks at the Minnesota Children's Museum, true treasure of the state, and Ms. Krizen, welcome. Please introduce yourself and go ahead when you're ready. Try to leave a little bit for questions if we have some at the end there, but we certainly want to hear what's going on. And thank you, Ms. Krizen.
Great. Thank you, Chair Lilly. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. I'm Diane Kreisen, President of Minnesota Children's Museum. And what I wanted to share with you today is starting first with just giving some context on the impact of the pandemic on the museum and what legacy funding has made possible that otherwise wouldn't have happened. So this chart here gives context about, you know, we're our fiscal year runs July through June, and so we are in our fiscal year 22 right now, and a third year being impacted by the pandemic. We closed in, you know, mid-March of 2020. You know, we closed before we were mandated to close because, as the governor talked about, needing to avoid crowds of 250, we were staring at a weekend where we would typically have more than 3,000 people, you know, in the building on both days of the weekend, and that just didn't feel like the right thing to do. So we closed, and like, you know, pretty much everybody at that time announced a 2-week closure and committed to paying our staff during that time period. But it became clear, right, as the pandemic, you know, rolled out, you know, before those 2 weeks were up, we knew we, you know, we're going to be closed longer, and we made the painful decisions to furlough most of our staff and give pay cuts, you know, to everyone, you know, impacted, you know, pay cuts of 50% or more, you know, in order to be able to survive, you know, an extended closure with that. Thanks to 2 PPP loans, I can say we would not be here today if it weren't for those PPP loans. We were able to bring staff back as we looked at reopening the museum then in August. But at that time, we had to resize our organization. Unfortunately, we had to eliminate 49 jobs. That's a third of our workforce. And we remain at that smaller scale at this time. We also had to pause our legacy projects, even though we were appropriated the funding. The way it works is it's a reimbursement model. So we have to incur the expenses, then submit that, and then get reimbursed for it. And, you know, during those days of the pandemic, we just couldn't cash flow that. And so despite, you know, having had those funds appropriated, we just couldn't access it because of that challenge in cash flow. But eventually, thanks to the PPP, we were able to, you know, bring some staff back and particularly retain a team of 5 in our exhibit department, thanks to legacy funding. And I want to highlight, you know, what that team has been accomplishing for visitors in our state. But just wanted to acknowledge that we continue to operate at deficits. I think things that are unique to us as a children's museum is that a large part of our audience continues to remain unvaccinated. Children under 5 still don't have access to a vaccine. 70% of our member families have a child less than 5, you know, in their home. So I completely understand families having different perspectives about feeling safe returning to an environment like the Children's Museum. And we've also not had the opportunity. We've sort of fallen through the cracks of other relief programs beyond the PPP that have been put out there. And so given the time, I won't go into any more of that, except to acknowledge that we do have House File 3563 this year. And thanks to Chair Lilly, who is the author of that bill, is a request for relief funding to really help the Children's Museum as we continue to run at deficits despite being a downsized organization. But given time today, I just want to move on and focus on, I look forward to, that's been referred to the Education Finance Committee. I look forward to testifying about that in more detail. But wanted to again highlight that thanks to legacy funding, we were able to retain a team of 5. And so what has that team been doing for that? I wanted to first focus on legacy funding and made it possible when we came back to pivot. Don't we all hate that word? We pivoted because we had to just redo our experiences at the museum. We had to adjust to encourage social distancing and increased needs for hygiene. And so these are some of the pictures of sanitation stations that we created and are all over the museum, and frankly will remain all over the museum even when this pandemic is apparently behind us, because that's just a good practice to keep. And then we also created graphics, like you see a couple examples here, of giving context to what 6 feet looks like for the social distancing. We also had to make changes to our exhibits. We changed out to materials that were just easier to clean, as we didn't know in those early days how the virus was transmitted. So really removed anything sort of soft and absorbent and that was a little bit harder to clean. On the left-hand side, you see these sort of giant blocks, Lego type blocks that just are a hard surface, was just very easy, easier to keep clean for that. And that has just, visitors of all ages have just enjoyed building very large structures with these materials. We also, we now know that it's an airborne virus, and so we removed any kind of air blowing activity. One of our popular activities was create your own ping pong ball launchers that used air. So we created a new design in the center there that uses bungee cords, one of the few materials that is indestructible to a six-year-old. It's amazing how they can find the weak links in any design you tend to come up with. But these ping pong ball launchers that are now manual and not air blown have become quite popular, especially with dads, I will say, with that. And so it was great to have the opportunity to design something new, and we will keep some of these even when we are able to bring back the air blowers. Also on the top right is another example when we took out the air blowers that we created, just put out some variety of materials and encouraged people to build off of a wall. And it's just amazing to see how long, families work together to create these long ball runs and really enjoy, again, a new experience that was made possible and something that we will keep going forward. We also needed to change out activities in our studio at the museum because we had to eliminate staff that provided facilitation in that space. So we had to come up with new self-facilitated activities, as well as, again, in those early days, we didn't want to have materials that visitors shared with each other. So some examples here with the hearts, we knew that families were feeling stressed, and we wanted to create opportunities for self-expression in this space. And so the hearts were under a branding of messages of hope and just encouraging people to just express whatever was in there. And we saw, messages clearly written by children that talked about the virus, as you see here, that talked about family and friends, that talked about the racial justice movement. Adults also needed this outlet, and we saw them also participating in these messages of hope, as well as a painting activity. You see this house here. We just had a large scale group painting activity that
went on. Sorry, Ms. Kreisen, I'm going to kind of just go ahead and just
wrap up.
Yeah, just say something that you're really important for us to hear. And then, not that everything is.
Right. Bad. Yeah. So, there's a variety of different experiences that have been created that, wish I could share with you, but just really want to end with thanks to Legacy Funding. I think the key thing is that we were able to create new experiences and to retain, more staff than we would have been able to retain for that. And just, this is one expression that was in that studio there. And we have just people have been very appreciative to have a place to bring their kids a sense of normalcy in this unnormal world with that. So just, one quote from a visitor to end with is, my kid actually has a place to play and touch and enjoy and feel like a kid in this pandemic. And the mask policy makes me feel better too.
Thank you very much, Ms. Kryzan. And, you know, telling your story, we'll work with you to figure out if extensions are needed or that sort of thing. And thank you for coming into the story or to tell your story. And all the other presenters today, thank you. And I'm sorry for the short timeline. And we're there to figure out how to adjust, because I know a lot of our arts and cultural facilities have been greatly impacted by the COVID situation. And with that, members, we're adjourned. Thank you very much.